Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And today's episode, it's a lovely episode today. I got to sit down with John Marsh of The Beloved. I've been a big fan of The Beloved for a long time. And through my friend, who I'm going to have to thank on this, Lee Antonio, he mentioned that he'd been chatting to John online and had mentioned the podcast, and through that an email was set up, and fast forward a couple of weeks and I got to sit down and speak to somebody whose musical output has been never far from my stereo, and it's always a bonus when you meet these people, and they're an absolute delight, which John was. Before we get on with the podcast, I would just like to thank 76 for producing this podcast. Also, big shout out to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. And thanks once again to Lee Antonio for helping put this together. And if you enjoy this, and it's potentially that and it happens to be the first time you've listened to Off the Beaten Track, then why not have a little look in the archives? Because there's about 150 episodes available with some of your favourite musicians, producers, DJs, comedians, actors. I won't list them. Go and have a rummage, because I'm sure you'll find something that you will enjoy. If that's not enough, I do also have a Patreon page where each week I put up a standalone episode as well. And you can find out about all of this at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Well, let's get on with things. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track Podcast with John Marsh of The Beloved. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music, and they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast, and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk. offthebeatentrack.co.uk. Official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Welcome to Off The Beaten Track podcast, and sitting opposite me today via the means of Zoom in lockdown is John Marsh of The Beloved. Hello.
Hello there. Yes, you've taken my Zoom virginity today. I'm the last person in the entire known universe to download and start using Zoom.
Wonderful. Well, it's been something that I've had to do, obviously due to the sort of situation that we find ourselves in. Every sort of podcast has had to, you know, sort of, and I guess every musician and every stand-up comedian and actor's all got to kind of find new ways to work around the situation we're in. So I'd like to start, before we get onto your track list, John, with just asking how you found lockdown as both a husband, father and human being, and as a creative.
Right. Well, as a husband, father, for reasons I won't go into last year, I'd had quite a lot of health issues. And when the writing was on the wall, we decided to get out of London before the lockdown even came along. So we came down to Cornwall. We have a really small place down here, which isn't really habitable in the winter because it's got no heating or anything like that. But we've been saved by the weather, actually. So I'm here with my wife, three teenage children and a dog. And I'm not going to lie about it. We've had, as a family, it's been an extraordinary period of togetherness and growth and discovery, really, because, you know, we've been able to have a lot of conversations about a lot of deep things, important things, you know, a lot of laughs as well along the way, because, you know, you have to. But, you know, my kids are 14, 16, 19. There's no conversation off limits in our house.
Yeah.
So as a form of spiritual, philosophical, political, economic education, it's been probably better than school, you know, because everything is there. Geography, geopolitics, you know, sociology, psychology, everything is in this mix. And so having treated it as something, you know, I'm not an authoritarian father, but it's important for me, obviously, in a situation like this, having never had it before, to put the interests of my immediate family first. That's kind of almost like instinct. That was my gut instinct. It's like, protect them, make sure we're okay, you know, reach out to extended family and friends as well as much as possible. And that's what you do. You have to. It's how I feel I've brought my kids up, is that, you know, if you want to change the world, you start by bringing your children up to be nice people. That's how you
100%.
How you set about doing it, really. And you can't do anything else if you haven't managed to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's, you know, we're still in it. I mean, that's the thing. It's, you know, you and I, we're talking at the start of June now, and it's like, well, nothing's answered, and the world is actually turning even more volatile and unimaginably, you know, difficult on a daily basis at the moment.
It feels like that. It really does feel like that. And I hope when people listen to this podcast in, you know, in 2021, they'll look back and just think, wow, that, you know, just, and hopefully they will be looking back on something that's, you know, the COVID side of things has been forgotten. And it's just a weird time in history that, you know, we'll look back on and just think, wow, that was crazy. I hope, you know, that there will be some kind of new normal by then.
Well, yes. I think anyone with a humanitarian heart would like to see elements of the slate wiped clean and we start again. I don't, you know, the cynic in me says that isn't necessarily going to happen, but you're seeing at the moment, this very, very moment, the sheer momentum of the will of vast amounts of people has the capacity, hopefully, to make changes and lasting changes, because people have had enough, you know.
Yeah.
It's bizarre that the thing that's not on the agenda at the moment anywhere, although we'll still, people have to remember that the climate crisis is still the one that's actually bigger than all of it. It's bigger than everything. It's bigger than any other issue, because it will take us all if we don't address that. And I sort of initially saw the pandemic as part of that, really. You know, as something that affects everyone, and you'd like to think that the world could have pulled together at that point and done something, but of course the world at the moment doesn't seem to have that capacity.
It was very strange. The first sort of few weeks of us being sort of told that we weren't, you know, we was only allowed to leave our homes for exercise. I'd go for my daily run, and where I live, it's, you know, there's a couple of like sort of parks that I like to run around with my dog in the mornings, and it did feel really, really amazing in regards to, there was no aeroplanes in the sky, there was no traffic on the roads, there was just clear blue skies, and it was like, it almost felt that the planet was starting to sort of
kick back.
It did feel like that. Very, very strange. So how have you found it as a creative, John?
Not as creative as I would have liked it to have been. I thought initially
that, everybody, I mean, says this. It's so weird.
You know, my kids brought computers to do their, the two of them still at school, so you know, doing their remote learning. My daughter's been through a process of auditioning for drama school, which she got into all by Skype auditions and things like that. So she's done that. My wife's at virtual college, and I've ended up being willingly as well. I'm not saying this to be humorous at all, but I mean, I've run the house. I've done I was the one who was designated to go out and do lockdown, do the shopping, do the whatever, and basically run it as a, you know, it, for want of a stupid expression, a 1950s housewife thing. I saw other people say that they've had to reduce their lives to that. And that was me for a few weeks. And I actually really loved it. I became very maternal and very sort of, you know, I do all the cooking and shopping generally anyway, so it's not an issue. But sort of the washing, the cleaning, you know, and getting lots of exercise. So yeah, it's all good. But Christ, I swear to God, it's only about the last 3 or 4 weeks that I've begun to be able to sort of liberate the creative side again. I think there's a kind of internal, I don't know, angst maybe. I mean, I haven't been in a state of like panic and fear and whatever about the global situation, but I think creativity requires a headspace as well. And if your head is just always just like, you know, literally, you know, I don't know, I can't even imagine what, I've just been thinking, where has this time gone? This time is just, it's been extraordinary. And as I said, we've bonded amazingly as a family. But I've been sitting here thinking, I've been down here now for 13 weeks. That's a long time. A long time, you know. And I've creatively just begun to feel, you know, that I can start doing things, which is weird because that's exactly the precise point in time that everyone else is being allowed to start going back to work. So it's interesting. Yeah, no, it's good. I mean, got lots of ideas, but finding blocks of time to actually do stuff with it, that's the issue. Because you can't, I mean, what I do when I'm working, I need 6-8 hour blocks to be able to do something. Because if it's good, you want to keep going. You can't just, but you know, someone has to take the dog for a walk, so
of course. It's weird. Okay, John, for track one, I'm going to ask you what you think is the song with the greatest ever intro.
Does it have to be a song?
Oh, well, that's an interesting response. I don't know. Well, what are you thinking?
I was going to say the theme from The Persuaders.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, of course you can have that.
Because the intro for that is just, it's still goosebumps. I mean, I remember hearing it as a kid because this programme was on, I don't know how old, how old are you?
I'm 47.
Oh, right, so you're much younger than me. So The Persuaders, do you know the programme?
Mm.
Yeah, because it used to be on a Sunday afternoon when the big match, which was the football highlights programme, was on. And they used to get these two programmes back to back on a Sunday. And so it's Roger Moore, Tony Curtis, gallivanting around the Côte d'Azur with the John Barry theme tune. And just that piece of music is just, it's got this incredible chords played on it. Like a harpsichord or something like that at the start of it, and a spinet or something, I don't know what it is, but and just mind-blowing chord sequence that, just instant drama, excitement. Well, part of it may be to do with my childhood sort of memory of, oh, you know, this is my favourite telly programme, my favourite day of the week, you know, you get the football, you get this, whatever. But actually, it's one of those pieces, actually, when you realise, you ask around, loads of people love that. Loads of people love it. It's possibly even more exciting than the James Bond music. You know, John Barry, I mean, yeah, just if people don't know John Barry at all, which, I, you know, maybe they do or they don't, but for instance, A band like Goldfrapp, hugely, hugely influenced by his music, had their first album. It's almost like an homage to John Barry's music, you know, and Ennio Morricone, those kind of film soundtracks. And yeah, this just ping, this sound, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, fantastic, fantastic. But it's not a song.
That's all right.
It's the theme from The Persuaded.
So I want to ask you, John, because I always ask musicians that come on this podcast, how much value and emphasis do they put on the intro when creating music, and has that changed over the years due to the way that people listen to music now is maybe slightly different to how they did when the Beloved first started making music?
Well, it's going to change, inevitably going to change, depending on what the structure of your band is, or you know, what your project, whatever it is. You know, half the music we listen to now is sort of not even people being in the studio collectively at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's people come and do their bit. So, you know, when we were like plugging away as a kind of four-piece indie band, the everything was worked out in the rehearsal room. So everything is you know, literally drummer goes 1, 2, 3, 4, and off you go kind of thing. Or occasionally you think, let's have something that's like textural, so it'll start with the bass and the guitar and then it'll build or whatever like that. And so you're kind of, you've got infinite permutations. And also when you've got people in a room all playing an instrument, you can literally start it, stop it instantly, try it like this, try it like that. You know, if someone is effectively, for want of a better term, you need to have someone in the room who's kind of got a kind of overview of a musical director who can, excuse me, who can be the person who says, right, try that, because otherwise you end up all arguing about it.
But every band needs that, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, you need some. But obviously now, I would imagine, it's a really good question, because it's probably diminishing art, I'd have thought. You know, if everything's programmed, if everything's too... you either think it through too much, or you have to literally construct it out of the building blocks of bars and beats on a screen, that you just basically, you know, for want of a better way, you do it, you would just loop that section and keep fiddling with it as it's going round and round and round and round. But that is much less organic. So I don't know. I mean, you can obviously, technology allows you to introduce any kind of sound now that you can possibly think of, and ones that you haven't thought of. But in terms of it being an intro that leads you up, I suppose, says the man who chose a non-vocal track just now, but to the point at which the singer starts singing, that's what an intro is, isn't it? It's the bit that takes you to the vocal starts.
Yeah, I guess another thing that I'd throw into that question was when you started having commercial success, John.
Yes.
Did radio become part of the thought process when creating intros to your music?
No, only in as much as that you would try not to make it too long, I guess. But that's not even thinking about radio. No, I think because not that I can consciously remember, no. I do remember that with one track we actually got knocked back by radio because they said the start of the song was too depressing and too difficult and slow. And that was actually kind of, you know, one of the last things we ever released. And it was like, okay, this is not great, because it's like, okay, what, you literally can't get radio programs saying we can't play this because it's too sort of soft and gentle and atmospheric, and you're like, wow, that's mad, because it's I'd never even thought about that conceptually, that could be something. But sometimes things aren't meant to happen. You know, just because someone says, I don't think your career is going to stand or fall by the fact that your intro is too long or too short or whatever.
You know?
I mean, if the song's no good, the song's no good. So but I don't know whether it consciously fed in. Not really. I mean, without being silly, you kind of unconsciously want every bit of the track to fulfil its function.
Of course.
You know, you want something that's impactful, or occasionally you want something that's a little bit unusual. I don't know. The only one that I can think of from my own stuff that's slightly weird is Hello, which has got the sound of an orchestra tuning up underneath it. But that was done because it was actually the first track on the album. It wasn't done as a way of... It wasn't meant to be about that for that particular song. It was me almost, again, a kind of deliberate reference back to Sgt. Pepper, which was the album that I first remember when I was a kid. That's how it starts. It's the same idea. Oh, here's the orchestra tuning up. And it's like, well... and I do remember when that went to radio, people didn't play that bit, obviously, because it's like, if you want to get your record played on radio, first of all, make the song have the word radio in the name of the song. They love that shit. It's just like ego massage. And then, and just something that they can waffle over, isn't it? It's like, oh, God. And that's the most irritating thing. It's marginally less irritating than when you've heard it, like, back in the day when the DJ decides they think they have a right to sing over your record.
Oh, my life.
You can imagine the Steve Wrights of this world. Like, it's like, bloody hell, man. It's just like, oh, Christ almighty, kill me now. You know?
John, track two. Yes. The first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
There's quite a few, actually.
You can have some honourable mentions, John.
Well, the thing is, if I contextualise this, that I'm the youngest by 9 years with three elder siblings. So I'm born in 1965. But my formative years, between the ages of 2 and 5, I'm in a house with teenagers, with Radio 1 having just started at this point in time. They're all buying records, they're all things. We had the radio on the whole time, and I was...
Where was this, John?
At home.
Yeah, whereabouts was it?
Where? In Dulwich, South London. Dulwich. Sorry. Yeah. Where was it? In the kitchen. It was in the kitchen.
where the radio was.
Yeah, I can visualise it. I can actually visualise it. It's like... certain records, especially there's a lot of those late 60s records have real drama and real sense of weirdness about it. So they're actually records, the ones I remember, I mean, there's two sides of this. There's the ones that I just remember being fantastically sort of happy and thrilling and whatever. But what I realised later on is that even then, even though I was hearing these things, and actually as an adult or as a teenager, began to realise the depths of it, that the tracks that I liked at the time were the most simplified thing. So a good example of this is both going to be about the Beatles, is like that. Okay, so first of all, which came first? Sgt. Pepper comes first. So I remember that coming into the house because... all of the family, apart from my mum, even my dad, who was quite an old man by this point, were so excited about this arrival of this record, you know. And I could see, I didn't understand, you know, I was probably 2 and a half, and it's like, wow, but everyone was obsessed. There's this new Beatles record, there's this new thing coming in the house. And we literally sat down and listened to it as a thing. It was a fucking incredible thing. If you think about this as a cultural event for a small child, it's like, oh. And I couldn't really get it. And I loved... you know, the sort of simplified songs. But I remember hearing She's Leaving Home on that album. And it left me feeling really sad and really bereft because it's about someone leaving. You know, it's about the sorrow of the parents and the daughter, and she leaves. And I didn't really understand anything about what it was about, but I just remember it had this incredible sense of loss, and it freaked me out. And when... for years and years and years, if I ever listened to that album, I'd skip that track.
Really?
Physically go and lift up the needle and move it across that track because I couldn't go with the emotional sense of it. Really extraordinary because, you know, it's just there's something melancholic about it that really, really got to me. And then the sort of flip side of that was that... when the White Album came out, which would be the next album, I think. I don't know the chronology of the albums. I think so. My favourite track on that, to my eternal shame, was Obladee Oblada, which is a bloody awful song. It's a terrible, you know, it's cod reggae. Terrible, terrible, terrible song. But for a little child, it's the best song on the album because it's, it's like a nursery rhyme. And now, you know, that's the one that I would, that's the one that I would never listen to as an adult. But again, I remember just thinking, this is great. This is really, really up and really happy.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, you know. And the way, the fact that I can remember so deeply the resonance of music on me at that age is kind of, it must have been so impactful. You know, as I grew older, I got exposed to incredibly diverse and powerful music by all of them at different points in my very early life. And although I didn't necessarily even like it, I you know, I know for a fact that, for instance, I heard the first Velvet Underground album when I was 4 years old because my brother was playing it.
Yeah.
And I would have been, I mean, it would have been coming out of his room and I'd have been like, oh, jeez, you know, that is, it's just, couldn't bear it, but it's like, it's there.
What must that sound like to a 4 year old?
Jesus. Yeah, you know, yeah, you know, and then, you know, he was playing his Grateful Dead records or his Frank Zappa records, which is awful music. I couldn't stand it. I still don't really get it. But then later on, then when they all got into Bowie and stuff like that, you know, and Roxy Music and stuff like that, this, you know, I was personally into, we'll come on to this in a minute about the thing about first record I bought, but, you know, so I had just an unbelievable exposure to a spectacular range of music from such an early age. So the emotional impact of it was like almost like an avalanche, really.
Yeah.
And I still feel like that about music. I still get really excited. Even, you know, I'm 55 years old, I still get a thrill from hearing new things, different things. You know, it's always that, really.
Are you obsessive with, like, music? So, by that, I mean, if you hear a new record you like, do you play it over and over and over?
Yes. And quite often there'll be, you know, or the genius bit now, of course, is that there's you know, 40, 50 years worth of back catalogue of everything to discover that you still, you know, it's like, how did I miss that? How did I not?
Yeah.
You know, that's mind-blowing as well. Stuff that's from way, you know, someone played me a psychedelic. Someone played me, now I'm not a Hendrix fan at all. I'm not particularly into Hendrix, but I know the obvious songs. I didn't even realise Hey Joe was a cover until quite recently. And then there's this mad psychedelic garage band version of it from like 1966. That's totally different record. And it's just like, wow, you know, it changes the way you view everything. That it's like a permanently shifting jigsaw puzzle where everything just suddenly, you see who listened to what at what time and was influenced by this and this and this. And, you know, just this morning I was reading in the paper about this guy, reading the obituary in the paper, this guy Kenny Young, who I vaguely knew the name, and it says he co-wrote Under the Boardwalk, and then later on it just says that he was actually the driving force behind the band Fox, who is a band that I loved, you know, and it's just like, okay, you know, this guy, he was doing that in the 60s, and then he came over here and lived in the Cotswolds. It's like, okay, it's like bizarre, and formed this band, and, you know, everything, I just, my entire life, especially through my childhood and teens and everything like that, is so mapped out by music, by the, you know, that incredible memory of being able to put in a time and a place from a piece of music and have such recall for it as well, you know. My wife, for instance, is much more about visual identity and photographic memory and things like that, and so she's got, I can't remember anything about what anyone looked like or the time and place or anything like that, but you put the song on, I'm there, you know. It's just, it's really interesting how that dominates my everything about the way I am, I think.
Yeah. I'm very similar like that, and it's a wonderful thing to have, it really is.
Oh, it's superb, you know. But what is important for me is to not lose that thrill of looking for it, you know. What always baffles me is mates of mine who, I mean, you know, they're good friends of mine who were obsessive about music, and then they just suddenly just sort of stopped.
Yeah, it's strange, like, isn't it?
That's like giving up on sex. It's like, no, you know, it's something that's going to give you amazing amount of thrill and pleasure and constant joy, and just saying, oh, no. And you know,
that was then.
No, it's still going. You know?
Yeah, it's
people
it's
don't
bizarre.
Do that with films. People don't do it with films.
Strange,
they
isn't
really
it?
They really don't. So why do they do it with music?
I've got so many friends that I grew up with, that I was in bands with, and things like that. And now they're like, yeah, I don't really listen to much music anymore. And it's like, you don't listen to much music anymore.
Even worse is then the follow-up, because it's not as good as it used to be. And that just does my head in, because it's like, mate, I'm not having that. You know?
And it's been a real joy to speak to so many musicians and creatives on this podcast, and so many of them are still so excited about new music. And, oh, yeah.
I think if you're not a fan at heart, then you're actually faking it, because I really do. I think you have to be a fan, because that's probably why you wanted to do it in the first place. Most, unless, you know, I'm not a trained musician. Lots of people I know aren't. You know, so I've no problem with people who are, but it was like literally hearing records and getting the thrill that I got from hearing the records and thinking, I want to do that.
Yeah.
Not because I want to be famous or successful. It's just this is the thing that's most exciting in my whole life. I want to know how to do this. And,
hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Search Off The Beat and Track podcast and you can listen to all the songs, because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode, so you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up and get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. I guess those formative years we're going to touch on there anyway. So for track three, John, the song that reminds you of your time at school.
Which school are we after? Any? Because I mean, primary, secondary.
Sometimes people throw a couple in, and generally the first one's never quite as cool as the second one.
Primary school, obviously, then is for me right through the whole 70s. That's my primary school. So you know, you've got a hell of a choice there. But actually. There's the question about the one you first record you bought. Is that coming up?
No, that's coming a little later. Yeah, that's coming next.
Isn't that going to be the same? Well, that's going to be very similar. So
I guess so. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It was because I was really into. I was out there spending pocket money when I was little. But from school, ironically. Well, not ironically. Slightly dubious, but it's just in terms of you know, we were all massively into Gary Glitter.
I
remember going to my mate Eddie Osmond's birthday party. He had a fancy dress party in about 74, maybe. I went as Gary Glitter. My sister sewed sequins on my T-shirt so I could go, you know. And we used to run around the playgrounds shouting and screaming, leader of the gang and all those kinds, you know. What can you say? Obviously, the guy's a complete, you know, is a disgusting individual, but it's the way that I refuse to accept that records can be then have to be just pretend they never existed as a consequence of this. You can't unhear it.
Well, it's very interesting having Gary Glitter's music used recently in the film The Joker.
And how powerful is that, though?
I mean, sonically, visually, when I saw that scene, I was like, fuck, it sounds Amazing. Looks amazing. And
apparently, though, they use that track in American sports. That's why it has a resonance in the States.
Oh, really?
It's not. You know, it's only British audience that are sitting there going, oh, Christ.
Right.
Because people, it's used in something like American football or something like that.
Okay.
I don't know.
That makes sense.
Know, yeah, baseball. Because they know it in the States from that. It has a cultural significance. Mm. Whereas for here, the cultural significance is, Jesus, that's dark. You know,
It's an ongoing sort of, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, you know, Gary Glitter is a terrible human being. But, you know, I do like to ask guests, because so many people have come on here and spoken about Michael Jackson, and loads of people have spoke about Morrissey, who I'm a huge fan of his work, but recently he's been saying some very, very bizarre things that I don't agree with. And just that whole thing of, can you separate the art from the person?
He's making it difficult. Morrissey is making it very
difficult. Oh, he really is.
You know, I mean, I loved the Smiths. I'm not really a massive fan of his solo career anyway. Yeah. But yeah, it's just bizarre. He's like a cartoon character, really. Mm. I don't really even want to go there with someone like that. But the Michael Jackson thing, the weird thing is that there's a posthumous apologists sort of like, there's never going to be I've literally had arguments with people going, well, but he wasn't convicted of anything, you know, this, we don't believe this, whatever. You know, people believe what they want to believe,
of
and there's
course.
Not much you can do about it. But the interesting thing is that I don't know whether his music hasn't been taken off the airwaves, has it? In the same way that, you know, Glitter's a convicted paedophile and is a really vile man, and that, you know, I totally understand that. I don't have an issue with that. But all I'm saying about it is that, I accept why his music wouldn't get played on the radio. I totally see why, you know, that's fine. But I'm not going to pretend that I didn't ever like the music or still,
yeah,
you know, I still got it. I know, this is true, actually. I've forgotten about this because I have it. I still have the singles and things in my iTunes library. And a couple of years ago, I can't remember where we were exactly. I think we were at home, but I was just running a random, you know, the shuffle thing. And we had friends around, and then one of the tracks came up. And it killed the conversation so dead. And people looking at me, and I'm like, oh, for crying out loud. And then by the end of it, everyone's like getting, you know, I'm singing along with these things. Come on, you know. So to separate out. No, obviously, it's a tricky one. His crimes
really
are legion, and he is an unrepentant. And he's inside, isn't he? He's in jail.
He is, yeah.
I mean, he's, you know, it's really vile what he did. Really vile. He went, you know, whatever. You know, he was a sex tourist, wasn't he? He was just like, ugh.
I think every artist should be judged on their own.
Yeah, but in terms of then saying that you can't ever listen to his music, or that there's something that somehow you're tainted if you do, I can't. It's like undergoing. Then I need to have a kind of moral re-education, brainwashing take place on me, because I can't pretend that my 8-year-old self didn't love that record.
Yeah.
That's the thing I'm saying, and so yeah, no, I do, yeah, it's a very interesting question. There's not a specific definite answer to it
absolutely.
Either.
Well,
Michael Jackson, I don't have such a problem with, because you know I like the singles, but I'm not. In fact, you've set me off now. I don't know what to say. I don't know. I mean, no, I tell you what, I was just thrown out of this because I hadn't. Again, me and my wife, we were doing some research. I can't remember what set us off thinking about this. I mean, we were looking up about Hound Dog, actually, because we were having a stupid joke about trying to sing it and remember how it went, and then started reading up about Elvis. Now, Elvis wooed Priscilla when she was like a 14-year-old. And I started reading. The more you read up about this, you're like, hang on a minute, wait, hang on, what?
Yeah.
What? I mean, Christ almighty.
Yeah.
There's some weird stuff in there.
Yeah, there really is. Let's not open that can of worms.
No, but I was just saying, then that takes down the, you know, in theory, the greatest
rock and roll
star ever. It's just like, what?
I know.
I mean, mate, she was a child.
absolutely.
But her parents let her go. Yeah, it's very odd. Anyway.
Well, let's talk about you being a child. So, at school.
Yes.
I mean, firstly, did you enjoy
school?
You're
breaking up on me. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I think so. Up to a certain point. I enjoyed my primary school a lot. I was really good at sports and I was good at most subjects, so I had a really easy time. It was all fun. And it wasn't until I got older and had to start doing subjects that I wasn't any good at and realised that it wasn't, that yeah. you couldn't just coast through life. You know,
yes.
you have to really work at stuff. And
it's
I was
shame,
terrible. I was terrible because I had just about enough things that I was either really interested in or good at that I could sort of get away with.
Yeah.
You know, there was a couple of sciences I was rubbish at and stuff like that. And as soon as you had to start doing proper subjects, it all got a bit difficult. But when it was all easy, you know, doing sums and stuff like that, it was, you know, it was just fun. I liked it. And I'd played a lot of sport and I was in school teams for everything. And, you know, so I loved all of that. It was good fun.
What did you want to be?
What?
What did you want to be?
When I was a kid?
Yeah.
I wanted to be the drummer in a pop group.
Wonderful.
I know. How good is that? You know, it's like the kid who says, I want to be an engine driver, and he's still driving trains, you know. It's like, that's what I wanted to be. Because I didn't play an instrument. I didn't realise that I could get away with eventually sort of teaching myself everything in order to be able to do it. And But I started out as the drummer and worked my way. It wasn't like an ego thing. I literally, you know, it's a convoluted story how I ended up singing, mainly because the guy who was singing didn't want to be the singer. And that was sort of, we'll all have a go. And I wanted to be, I know, it's ridiculous, isn't it? Because it's like how I'm trying to bring my kids up and say, well, life isn't that straightforward, you know.
Yeah.
What do you want to be? Okay, yeah, you know. Yeah.
So was you a confident kid?
Yeah.
Show off? Did you like a bit of attention?
Funny enough, not as an individual, as part of a collective unit, yes.
Hmm.
But I was given a lot of attention, so that's a really brilliant question, but I think because I was given it. And like I said, because I had this household of mother, father, three teenage siblings, I got a lot of adult or, you know, faux adult attention in that environment and dialogue and conversation and things like that. So I was kind of being raised to be very sociable and outgoing and what have you. And I was, so I was confident and I think I was given attention because I was effectively almost like being an only child to some degree in that environment.
Yeah.
So I don't think I had to try very hard to get attention.
Sure.
So that is slightly different from being a show-off, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I loved it, you know, in the same way that I liked it when my mum came to watch me play football kind of thing. But I didn't want to have to be carried off the pitch on the shoulders of my teammates having scored all the goals. It wasn't quite that much. I'd make the pass rather than take the shot if it was for the benefit of the team.
Good answer.
That's what I like to think
of
myself.
Good answer, Joe.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, track four, what was the first song that you bought from a record shop?
Well, I remember actually there's two things. There's the dreadfully uncool one, which is
that's the one I want to know.
Okay, certainly remember spending pocket money I know where I went. I went to W.H. Smith's in Forest Hill with my mum, and it must have been either after Christmas or something like that. And going up in the way that shops like that always had a little record department then, Woolworths, Smith's, all of it. You know, it's an extraordinary world, really. Great world, actually.
And Boots the chemist did as well.
Did they?
Yeah, you still get records in Boots, yeah.
No, I didn't know that. Mm. I didn't know that. When we get to the other one, I'm going to tell you where I bought my first record, where I used to go and... this is the question, isn't it? Sorry. There's two different lots of things. So the... I bought a double A-side of Jake the Peg and Timey Kangaroo Downsport, right? Rolf Harris. Picture sleeve on a funny little label. And had it for years and years and years. And I discovered about, I don't even know what little path led me to doing this, looking. Oh, someone put a picture of something up, or I don't know. I went and looked for the sleeve of this and realised that it's not Rolf Harris. It's like, you know, the way they used to do those Top of the Pops albums with people covering the songs like that. So it's not Rolf Harris. It's someone pretending to be Rolf Harris. It sounds like Rolf Harris. And it's a double A side of Rolf Harris songs, but nowhere on the label, I've suddenly realised, nowhere on the sleeve or on the label does it say Rolf Harris.
Oh, well, you're perfectly fine to have that in the collection.
Because it isn't bloody Rolf Harris. And I was like, so the first record I bought, I discovered after 40 years later, it's a con. It's a lie.
You've been had, mate.
It's on Music for Pleasure or something is the label. It's genius. And so it was that. I was like, okay. But I remember... what I do remember about the experience is I was there and I was trying to choose. I know that I was coerced by my mother into buying this because I remember going wanting something more, whatever is subversive in the mind of a 5 or 6 year old. Because as I said, I'm already listening to cooler music in the house. And I remember being shepherded towards this by her because I think she knew the songs and she wanted songs because she wasn't into music. She was the one member of the family who wasn't into pop music.
Yeah.
And I remember that sort of slight sense of deflation because I think I probably wanted something else at the time. But then the first time I remember going by myself to buy a record, this is the week I was going to go to, it was about 3 years later, so I'd be about 8. And there was a barbershop in East Dulwich called Seegers, S-E-G-A-R-S, where it's where I had my first proper haircut as well, actually. And proper old barbers with Durex in the windows, that kind
brilliant.
Of
like, man, brilliant.
You know, and photos, Brill Cream photos and all
black
that.
Black and white Brill Cream photos. Yeah.
Real blokes, real male environment, really weird, you know. Yeah. And all the men, they all had those kind of weird, all the cutters all had like nylon jackets themselves, all in the same colour. So it was all a bit weird. Anyway, they had at the back, they had an electrical shop, so you could buy radios and food mixers and stuff like that. And they also had a few records, just 7-inch singles. But they always had like the top 30, 40, but they only ever had like one of each. So I don't even understand what the rationale was. So there must have been like a salesman came around every week and said, right, give this here, what have you. And then I twigged. So I remember the first thing I bought was Blockbuster by Sweet, which is very topical because Mr. Priest just died. And Sweet with the first, that was the first time I'd ever seen that, done that whole thing of seeing a band on Top of the Pops and thinking, oh my God, you know, this is so exciting, and wanted to go and get this. And
honestly, John, so many people have come on this podcast and the impact that Sweet had had on them has been crazy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. You know, it was a sort of a redux version of the real light of what teens were into for glam, wasn't it? It's for smaller children, really. It was like because it's that famous thing about so like a brickie with makeup or something, isn't it? It's but I remember going and getting it. I've still got it on an RCA orange label and. But what I was going to say is the funny thing was I tweeted about this shop that, I don't know how much a single was at the time, you know, it was, relative to my pocket money, it would still be a lot. But that if you monitored the chart places, if they dropped in the chart, they reduced the price of the single. So you could go and pick it up like a week or two later for half the money. Which
you
is
got smart
massive,
to that, right?
You know? Yeah, but I remember the genius bit, and I hadn't thought about this until I saw your question this, was about, you'd be hedging on the basis that no one had bought that record. So you'd be basically gambling on the possibility that it's still going to be there. Because if they only got one copy, if someone buys it, it's gone.
Yeah.
And I remember going back every week to see if they'd got certain things. And honestly, 50-50 chance that it isn't there. And the sense of like, going through the thing, just, is it there? Is it there?
Brilliant.
Oh, no, someone's bought it. And it's just like, wow, and to the extent that I'd forgotten that about that whole sensation. It was like probably about a 5-minute bike ride. So I'd cycle through the park, going through these. The things, is it there? And then if it wasn't there, you'd go through them again to make, oh, no. And so there must be certain things that I really loved that I never got to have. But But even then, you know, this is at the age of 8, I was saving up my pocket money to buy records. So, you know, that's pretty obsessional as well, because, you know, I did buy comics as well, but I mean, that, you know, Wizard and Chips and the Sweet single, it's a kind of weird... It's a weird...
Sounds like a great combo.
It sounds like a great combo. Yeah. And the other thing is about that whole rationale about buying the singles is that, because, again, you know, you're starting from point zero where you've got records that you own. You know, there's records in the house, obviously, that I was allowed to play that belong to other people, but the records that are my records...
Yeah.
You obsess about it. You not only learn the track inside out, you learn the B-side inside out as well, because that's... you know, I didn't understand that the B-side was supposed to be like a diminished... So, you know, there was something that quite often they'd toss off in, you know, a couple of hours. So what do we stick on the B-side kind of thing? But I used to imbue these things with the same amount of importance because I didn't know any different. It's like, okay,
whilst sitting there devouring the sleeve whilst listening.
Well, no, but the problem, but they didn't really, those kind of, back then, those, especially in those kind of shop like that, they didn't have pictures. They'd always be like the generic label sleeves. Yeah. But they're things of beauty as well, you know.
Yeah, it's so
proper
weird.
There was paper sleeves,
The paper sleeves, there was always a shop around the corner to me. It was like a newsagent's, but they had a rack of... singles that, if again, it was all about timing. I think they're about 70p a single,
right?
But they were the ex jukebox, so they'd come from the jukebox. The middles are cut out, and you had to sort of clip your little middle in it. But you could get it all in there, and it was if you prepared to wait sort of three or 4 weeks, you could get yourself a cut price single.
Jukebox singles also sometimes they used to. Do unique pressings where they'd put two A sides.
That's right. Yeah.
So you could pick up, they have a sort of rarity value now, don't they? Because if it's an artist, no one's going to want the B side, the real B side. So they actually put something better. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
More better known on the other side. Yeah.
Track 5, the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing.
Where'd you start? Really? Where do you start? I don't know. I've thought long and hard about trying to answer this one. I still don't. I was hoping that something would just come to me in the moment.
Let me break it down a little bit then, John. So what was the sort of first sort of clubs you was going to?
Well, bearing in mind that I came from a much more sort of indie alternative background. I didn't come from a sort of soul dance background. And when I was at Sixth Form College in 1983, I remember in the common room, the common room there was full of like, we literally tribal. So you got the soul boys and soul girls at one end, me and my black, like Echo and the Bunnymen overcoat up the other end, sort of, you know, this thing. But weirdly enough, was a bit when I began to realise that actually I quite liked some of this music as well. Yeah. You know, it's sort of the time of things like, I don't know, Imagination. They're probably the band for me that completely sold me on the idea that actually I did really like this. I hated jazz funk. I couldn't get jazz. I didn't. So Level 42 were big, Shack Attack were big, all those kind of bands I didn't like. But Imagination just had that funk, probably in retrospect, because it's so electronic, actually.
Yeah.
It's proto house, really, in many ways.
And if they were on Top of the Pops, I mean, visually, that was something to behold as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, just brilliant. I mean, everything about it, those records are they're timelessly brilliant. Yeah. They sound amazing now. And so certain things that do that, I think of every era has records that sonically are stuck in that era, and some always seem to have that transcendent ability to still sound good at a later point in time, and that especially 80s, early 80s, mid 80s, when the technology was, there was a lot of clunky technology and a lot of people had the same sounds on, massive drum sounds on all their records and things like that. There's something about the Imagination records, they're very minimal and they're really, really cool. They looked like, someone pointed this out to me, that they look, you know, in like terrible TV sci-fi series like Blake Seven or Doctor Who, and the people, they have those weird, they look like they were wearing stuff from the wardrobe.
They look like they're bought straight off the set of Flash Gordon.
Yeah, just probably homemade, you know, just extraordinary.
Yeah, Lee John looked incredible every time he was on Top of the Pops.
Fantastic. So I started going to clubs about 1981 when I was about 16, to proper clubs. First, you know, clubs with built-in sound systems and things. But I was mainly going to gigs at that point, so I was still going following bands around and stuff like that. So I didn't really start going clubbing until about 1984, 1985, and 1920, and going to... there was a club called the Flim Flam in New Cross, in where they had Rob Day, Jonathan Moore from Cold Cut was the DJ. That was the thing. And this was before Cold Cut were big.
Yeah.
And then I remember being there one night. This kid from Forest Hill who just won the world DMC, he was the UK DMC champion, came in and did 10 minutes. Of cutting and scratching, and that was CJ McIntosh when he was just like a fresh kid, you know. Yeah. He was like a scratch DJ. It was amazing, and this was so that was me being exposed in a proper club environment to music. I didn't know what the music was half the time, and just beginning to hear it. And then a couple of years later, some of those DJs started playing house and clearing the dance floor with it as well. That was the amazing thing. And then we'd started going up. Because I was South London, so we'd started going up to the West End, going up to Heaven quite a lot. Because
was that when Mark Moore was DJing?
It would have been, but I didn't. He was DJing at Busby's at the Mud Club and places like that. Heaven was just like mainly just gay club nights, but the system and the actual space was so brilliant that I don't really know who would have been the DJs actually, to be honest. But just being in an environment that, and the original Fridge in Brixton as well was another club. Now the Fridge when it started was a much smaller space above the shops near the tube station in Brixton, and they literally it was the inside of the space was meant to look like you were inside a fridge. So yeah. It was all white with like bumpy walls that looked like ice and things like that, and that was a mad little club. But, you know, clubbing wasn't such a big deal then, and that was the thing that was really interesting, because you'd go to different places and everywhere had its own sort of regular crowd, and sometimes you'd go in and people were really friendly, sometimes you'd go there and you'd get really cold-shouldered and you wouldn't go back, whatever, and little cliques, little scenes, whatever, and just... and then, obviously, it's sort of... late 87, early 88, it just all suddenly completely changed, and that, you know, the whole house thing that just sort of... knitted it all together in a way that all that kind of all the dress code stuff, all the like who you know kind of thing, it vanished, and it was so brilliant, because you know it meant that it just it became all about the music rather than just about a kind of posy sort of thing. So for me, I didn't, you know, that's when I really felt liberated by it. I mean, I liked going out and I liked dancing, but it was never a relaxed and you know, I don't know, it was always slight, I don't know how to describe it really. It was just all...
What did you want from clubbing?
I wanted to hear, and still do, to hear music that I don't know put together by someone who can actually like play with my head, really, you know.
Yeah.
I want someone to make, I want to be there, and I can, I've done it even now, even though I know, obviously, I know how to DJ, because I did for a long, long time. But in terms of the, I don't know, the last couple of times I've been out, both to see friends of mine play, one Luke Solomon and the other one Derek Carter, but literally standing in the DJ booth, watching them with the technology that they're using now, listening to the music, and I have a fairly good understanding of how things work, and still not being able to work out what the hell they're doing, because they're that good at what they're doing that they're just twisting it and messing with you. And just like, wow, you know, just, that's what I want from it. I want to experience an excitement in the moment that is being created by the skill of the DJ.
Yeah.
The idea that just to go to hear the record you already know played louder is utterly alien to me. I don't understand the point of that at all. But then, you know, for some people, it's just still just something to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You still ain't gave me a record.
No, because I don't know. I can't. All right. I'm going to go back into the first record that I remember hearing when I began to think, right, the music is changing and I don't know what this is and I don't know how they're making it, but it makes me just want to literally lose my shit on the dance floor, will be All in All by Joyce Sims.
Oh, what a great choice, mate.
Because it's a game-changing record for me. It's, you know, Mantronic's production with a soul vocal on top.
Is that Mantronic's production? I didn't know
that.
Yeah.
He produced all that, Come Into My Life, and that he produced it. Curtis Mantronic produced it. And that's why it's so good, because it's like someone coming from a hip-hop kind of freestyle background. And it's just that one album they made. Because everything she did after that is a bit insipid. But it's just like, oh my God, this is that stabbing synth that just comes screaming at you. And you're just like, what? The beats, everything. It's like electro meets freestyle meets whatever, like nothing else. And again, it's just, just everything about it. Brilliant.
Same.
Because I remember just thinking, this is the future. This record is the future. It changed it all for me. When I first went to New York in 87, that was the kind of music I was really, really into. I met the Latin Rascals, and it was like, oh my God, you know, these guys were doing the edits on these records. And I went to the studio, like someone, I can't remember how I got hooked up, but I went to watch them at work. They were literally there with, you know, this is when you had to edit with tape and razor blades and cutting it and sticking it all together and just watching them work. And it was like an art form that is now lost because people just do it all digitally. But it's like just amazing. And just these two guys who just knew, had this sort of instinctual understanding of how to do it. And so those records, from what I'm... know about it is that so Mantronic would, he was producing it, he'd do the beats and the whatever, she'd do the vocal, but then they'd give those the mixes to these two guys, Latin Rascals, Shep Nunes and someone else, and then they would kind of pull it apart and stick it all back together and do these funny snap edits and little backwards things and everything like that. And those little things were like the kind of pixie dust on top that gave it that sort of shock of the unknown, because things happened because of these edits and because of the reversing things. They made things happen sonically that you couldn't have done in the actual studio,
sure,
because there wasn't machinery that would make that bit go backwards and that bit jump to this and this. So it was like having an extra layer of creativity put on top of the record. Fantastic. It still to me would be like, if I was in a room now, it's a call to arms to me, that record. If it comes on, I'm there. I'm absolutely there, yeah.
Wonderful. Track six, favourite song from an artist from your home county.
Well, I'm London, so I've got a lot to choose from.
Okay.
But I'm going to go, he might be from yours actually, but I'm going to go Mark Hollis.
Oh,
because
we claim him in Essex, by the way.
Exactly, yeah, that's what I'm going to say. But he's an East London geezer, you know, he's an Essex boy. But again, with the more I learned about him after he died, and the realization that he was self-taught as well, I blew my mind, because he ended up making music so complex and so incredible and unique music. And so his career trajectory, just, you know, from a band that I'm not comparing myself in any shape or form, but I understand exactly what happened to them at the start, that when we got signed to a major, they were trying to mould us and manipulate us. And, you know, Talk when they first started, I remember seeing them and just thinking, oh, God, that's another bunch of boys being made to look like a sort of faux Duran Duran kind of thing. And they fought their way through it. And within, like, two albums, three albums down the line, they'd become something quite amazing, quite incredible. A unique way of singing as well, actually.
Completely.
You know, just incredible. And records that really stand the test of time. So, I guess it's very hard to pick one. Possibly because I don't know. Have you ever seen the videos for some of this?
I've seen them all.
The video, you've seen the Living in Another World one where they got the piano in the, where he's floating. Yeah, that. I would go for that as well, because I just think that track is just so...
I can't think who it was that guested on here. We was talking about Talk Talk videos. And we was talking about, I had like the best of, which was like called the VHS called
Natural History. Yeah, I have that. Yes, I have that.
Yeah. There's a scene on there where I think they're filming the video a Dum Dum Girl.
Yeah.
And they're clearly off their fucking heads.
Where's Tim Hope doing all the vids, isn't it? Yeah, they're all tripping. They're all tripping. Yeah, yeah.
And like, and they're talking to the camera, and like, and as a really young lad, I didn't know what was going on. I just thought, he seems pretty bonkers. And like, and you watch it now and you think, he's off his fucking mind.
No. Yeah. But it was just, they must have just sat around and said, right, we're going to do this. Let's do this. Yeah, why? Let's do this. And then they did it. And it was like, okay, we'll do that. Why not? Because we can. And just genius. And I just, and the fact that he, you know, he did everything he wanted to do and then he just walked away and, from what I gather, just raised his family and watched his kids grow up, and his wife's a teacher, and they lived in suburban Wimbledon. No one even really knew where he was or anything like that. I just hope he had a very happy and fulfilling life in that period when he stopped making music. I'm sure he did.
I'm going to show you something. It'll be 2 seconds. Right. I've got to grab something and show you something on my wall.
Okay.
When he passed, I had an artist create this picture of Mark.
Fantastic.
And it's pride of place in the wall in the studio. Yeah.
Okay, well, I've pressed the right buttons.
You really have. Joyce Simpson, Talk.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, no, well, we're speaking the same language. That's why music is so brilliant.
Because, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And when you, if you're a fan, you will have done. When you hear him, in audio of him being interviewed, and he's such a geezer.
He's such a geezer, isn't he?
You just think he's going to be like this sort of, I don't know. I thought he'd be more rarefied than that, and he's not. He's just a bloke. It's great. Yeah, just a bloke making unbelievable music.
That's the thing. He does just sound like an absolute geezer, and most of the time he looked like a painter and decorator.
Yeah.
He just created this magical stuff. That's what I want from my pop stars. Last track, John, a song you can play DJ again, a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
That's an interesting one. I mean, that could, you know, again, on any day of the week, 365 days, this is going to be a different answer, but it's weird. I was just listening to stuff over the weekend. We've got this. I'm not doing this as a sell thing, but I'm just going to tell you why I chose this. Is that I've had to be. We've got these remaster things coming out of ours, and I had to just provide accurate lyrics because digital platforms want to have the lyrics to go alongside the songs now. That's how it works. And actually, when you go and realise that your stuff, you look online and it's all wrong. Someone's sat there and someone's done it. So it's great. So it's just like to sit there and listen to my own music. And then the realisation of why one particular song sounds the way it does. And I'd entirely forgotten about this track that was a kind of... I can choose it in sincerity because it does. I didn't rip it off. But I can see where it fed into the way my song sounds. So it's quite obscure. I've got it in my library. I don't know. I haven't looked to see whether it's online. So it's by a band called Voice of America. So, yeah, see, no recognition there straight away.
No.
Right. So if you need audio of it, I might have to send you the MP3 or something.
Okay.
I don't know. Track called Story of Love. And it's like a, but it's the extended mix. So it's a track that when I play, it starts off like it could be the best Balearic track ever, but then it goes a little bit clunky. But I think you'll love it, given that you like the other two things. It's got that sort of certain thing in it, but it fits this category very well because it's obscure.
Yeah.
And I remember, I've got the 12-inch of it at home, and it's a brilliant record. I don't know if they ever made any other records or anything. I don't know whether it's like one of... Sometimes people have that sort of capacity to make one brilliant piece of music, and then that's all they're ever going to do, you know. So Story of Love, extended mix by Voice of America. And I guess it must be from about 86 or 87. I haven't even checked that out yet.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's certainly, since you don't know it, then that means it probably is pretty unknown.
Well, there's I always put a Spotify playlist together to accompany the podcast, so
Hang on, do you want me to, let me just quickly look if it's on Spotify. I don't even know if it is. Is that going to be a problem if it is?
No, not at all. Not at all. So you've been sitting there.
Oh, yes, it's here.
And
but get this. It's got less than 1,000 plays on Spotify. That's obscure.
Right. Well, it'll have a few more soon.
Yeah. So, perfect. I will...
There we go.
I know my way around technology. Hang on.
And so, you've been writing down your lyrics, so...
Wait. I'm just doing this now while I remember. There we go. I've sent you an email link to it now.
Wonderful. Thank you, mate. Yes. So, I'm just curious. You said you've been sort of going back, and... I mean, let's talk about the reissues and what's happening first.
Yes. Oh, sorry. No, I mean, yeah.
That's your job, not mine.
No, I know. But I'm not... I mean, much as I like... The things that I've done, I'm not a great salesperson for it, but the Happiness, which was the first proper album that we released, has been crying out for a remaster, actually, because it was 1990. It was still in that transition period from, you know, when music was, formats were changing. It was sort of half vinyl, half CD, and it was all a bit I'm not entirely certain whether it was only ever like mastered for vinyl and then not, you know, the CD is that era when things didn't sound that great. Put it on, it sounds a bit quiet and whatever. So we got all the analog tapes and remastered it, which is really good. That's been reissued on vinyl. We got away from Warner's a few years ago. We're on a small label now who has art. They bought us and 07 and Dirty Vegas and stuff, all from Warner's, which is great because now we're with a company, people our age, who are really into the music and just, you know, it's fun. It's actually fun again to do. So, and I've been, you know, still mates with Steve from that point in The Beloved. So we've been curating this together. Then there's a second disc with all demos and unreleased songs and things on it as well coming. So that's been quite a nice thing to do. But I've had to be... organising all the logistics of all the artwork and everything like that from lockdown. So that's been quite weird as well, because two meetings with for a couple of afternoons in a room with people would have got it all sorted out. It takes forever.
Yeah.
But what's been amazing is that I managed to resume contact with this guy, Bob Linney, who used to do all these amazing graphics for all our artwork, and made touch with him. So we got some new stuff from him, which is really nice.
Wonderful.
So it looks lovely, and... Literally, I'm just in the middle of writing sleeve notes, which have to be in by tomorrow, to sort of try to frame everything. But so there's a 2 CD, believe it or not, CD, which is, you know, dying. But it's the only way you can put all the music together, because putting it all on vinyl would just be stupidly expensive.
Of course.
So there's a proper vinyl, a 2 CD thing. But I mean, you can listen to it all for free on Spotify anyway. So. It will all be going up at the very end of July, I think it's coming.
And for listeners be able to find out all about that and what you're doing, where's the best place for that, John?
Okay, there is a website which is beginning to sort of animate at the moment, but I mean, because we haven't been putting stuff out, it's laying quite dormant, but it will be beginning to animate. So there's The Beloved... I should know it off by heart, shouldn't I? No, because it used to be .com and it reroutes now. I think it's thebeloved.uk is a suffix now, I think. Hang on. I ought to know this thing. But what we do have that is really, really good is if you're on Facebook, there's a group which is like a community. That's the thing that's the most active, which I participate in. It's quite a small thing, but it's a very, very nice environment where, you know, there's a sort of... Uber fans meet to discuss things, but I chip in. I often offer like free downloads of rarities and obscure stuff for people and things like that. So it's kind of, you know, it's quite a nice organic potted history, and it's where I tend to flag most things. There's, you know, there's an Instagram and all these kind of things. There's all the usual things. If you go looking for it on the internet, there's all the things.
Sure.
But it grows at its own pace. It's not. You know, I think you get to a certain point, especially when you're just focusing on older material, that, you know, you can't start trying to, like, flag wave and bomb people with it in the way that, you know, contemporary artists would with their brand new single, because it isn't, sure. It's not that thing, you know. So
the Facebook group, so is that under the name The Beloved?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And that's really good fun, actually. I mean, you know, that there's it's weird. There's some very obsessive people there. Wonderful. My God. You know, they've all come crawling out of the woodwork, and it's quite nice. You know, I mean, it's weird. It's a reverse thing. I mean, I suppose it's slight ego massage for me, but at the same time, if I was that much of a fan of a band and I had access to the band to be able to literally engage in dialogue with them and discuss what they're doing and stuff like that, yeah. Even if it is 30 years down the line or whatever like yeah. that, I think it's quite a nice, you know, it's quite a nice thing to be able to do.
Why do you think we started a podcast? Yeah. I wanted to chat to all the people whose music I love.
Yes, fair enough. Absolutely. Yeah, no. But then we come back exactly to the concept of being a fan,
yeah.
You know, which is what I was talking about earlier, the idea that, you know, I can understand, you know, it, although I have to sort of disassociate slightly to understand that people that I am the object of fandom from people. It's a very small thing, and it's quite fun, you know.
Yeah.
Apart from anything else, you know, if you've made music and people, you'd be an idiot to say that the idea that people then saying, I really like the music that you've made, isn't fantastically rewarding, you know.
Of course it is.
It's a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're not currently putting much out, it's even better if you can find some people to come and say, yes, I like it, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. John, thank you so much for giving up your time today. It's been a real really joy fun, chatting.
Yeah. Lovely.
Okay, I'll let you get back to writing your sleeve notes in sunny.
Tell me what you think of that Voice of America track, though.
I will do that now.
Let me know how you get on with that and see what you think.
All Thanks right. again, nice John.
Okay, cheers, mate. Mister. All right, bye-bye now.
Well, there you go. Wow. Never thought I would be talking about Joy Sims and Talk Talk in the same conversation. Absolutely wonderful. Absolutely brilliant guest. Thanks so much to John for giving up his time. Thanks to you lot for listening. That's much appreciated always. The best thing you can do if you enjoyed this is to go and have a rummage. I mentioned it at the beginning. Go and have a rummage in the archives and see if there's anything else you like. The best thing to do is just subscribe. Then each week, you don't even have to think about it. You just get a little episode pop up on your listening device. So, and it really helps the podcast. And if you really want to help the podcast as well and support it, then, as I said at the beginning as well, there is a Patreon page, patreon.com off the beaten track podcast. And you can find out about everything at www.offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Stay safe. I'll see you next week. Mind ego. Bye bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. Podbiblemag.com.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Beautiful.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.